Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I'm Josh and I am joined by Connor.
Hello there.
And we are going to be talking about when does something become a vice. And we're not necessarily going to be moralising. It's hopefully going to be a sort of breakdown of things that helps you think about things in a way that is helpful to you. We're not going to be, you know, judging and moralising and wagging our fingers, because I don't think that's productive and I don't think that actually makes anyone want to change.
But I'll just leave now. I'm joking. I think what brought this around has been off-air conversations about where the fine line is for most people. Who, some people are drawn like a moth to a flame to things that harm them. Others can, and this was the phrase we used off-air, microdose in degeneracy and get away with it. And so this will be more of a discussion, I think, yes, about the morality of vice is a morally loaded word, but how to mediate and incorporate or abstain from things which might do you harm over time into a workable schema of your life.
It's mainly looking at the consequences of people's actions, right? Rather than saying, oh, you're immoral. And because that's not really that interesting. I think most people who are watching this come at this sort of thing with the same or similar moral frameworks. Obviously, there's variation, of course, but I don't think that we really need to tell people what is wrong and what is not, because, you know, we've been around for long enough that you have a general gist, and it would be boring if we just said, yes, we think that this is wrong. But I suppose we may as well address what is a vice. And of course, most people have an understanding, but I think a concrete definition that we can work off and be specific, as we're trying to draw a very fine line between what is vice and what is not. And I have defined it as a habitual behavior that is either considered immoral by society or undesirable to the individual who has habituated it. And habit is the important part, because this also reflects the neurobiology aspect of it, in that, you know, you form a habit, it creates a neural pathway in your brain that makes following that habit even easier, the default sometimes. And so there's a lot of utility in emphasizing the habitual nature of vice. For example, if, say, you got really, really drunk one time at a wedding, and, you know, maybe you made a bit of a fool of yourself, but then...
So 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Yeah, bit recent memory for Connor. Yep. But
good time, though.
But, you know, it's a one-off. It's not something you normally do. You wouldn't describe yourself as an alcoholic, as having a vice with alcohol. You'd say, well, you know, I was treating myself as a special occasion. And therefore, you know, I don't see that as necessarily a problem. And I think that that's the view that most people hold. Not everyone is quite so fire and brimstone, just like, yes, even a sip of alcohol and you are going to hell. And, well, I mean, even the Islamic world doesn't think of it in that sense, does it? It's getting drunk, losing your inhibitions.
There are certain Christian sects in America, particularly behind the Prohibition era stuff, like the Puritans or even some Baptists, who do stigmatize it in that way, but it's not all that common across cultures.
No.
Two elements that I would like to introduce, both off the back of your example and your definition. And this isn't necessarily my definition, it's just things to consider. I would say that a vice is something which inhibits your state of moral readiness, that when you are in a position to be called upon, when a crisis strikes, that it diminishes your capacity for others to depend on you. What's a good example of this? So this is partially the Christian conception and also the Aristotelian idea of eudaimonia, right? If you are a habitually virtuous person, if you do things which noble you, it makes your capacity for moral exercise far more capable when someone comes to depend on you in a crisis-like scenario than if you were turning to booze or drugs to numb yourself to it.
So it effectively makes you a less competent person. You have less agency in the world.
Yeah. So this is the difference between... So to use a Christian analogy... Because you never know the hour at which judgment comes, you have to be in a state of constant readiness. This actually links to your discussion of Revelation in your Epochs with Bo. This is why the idea that if the if rapture is going to occur in your lifetime, it actually doesn't justify you having a ton of wives and being immoral. It actually means that if you believe that it's imminent, but you don't know the hour at which it will arrive, then don't practice vices, because when you come to be judged, you won't be judged favorably. And mm-hmm. so to secularize that analogy, when a great tragedy unexpectedly befalls your family and you are the person to which they look to shoulder the burden of your father's coffin or to cry on, you can't be in a state where you are weak and they cannot depend on you, because they deserve, just by them being good people, they deserve your ability to comfort them. And then to extrapolate off the wedding example, if it's a one-off, a vice is not falling afoul of not knowing your exact limits, specifically because as well, your alcohol tolerance will change over time.
You don't know your limits until you actually, you know, go off a precipice. Yeah. And I think it was Hunter S. Thompson, of all people, who I feel knows vice very well.
He continually tested his limits.
He did, yeah. He said, you don't know where the edge is until you go tumbling off. Mm. And I think that's actually very true, that, you know, you've got to go over the edge a little bit to know where the limits are. Mm. And I can understand if people are sort of hesitant that they don't want to do that. But more often than not, going over the edge just means I behaved in a mildly stupid way that ultimately won't have that many consequences. If, you know, you're one of those people who gets really drunk and tries to steal the crown jewels or something, and, you know, it ruins the rest of your life. Mm. I think you'd be very unlucky to do that as your, like, first example.
And exceptionally ambitious as well. I think there are certain things where you don't need to hit rock bottom in order to understand they're bad for you.
Yes.
So there are certain hard drugs. There is the fact that you don't need to go out and play AIDS roulette by having promiscuous sex to know that it might not be the best idea mm-hmm. to hook up with a stranger in a truck stop, for example. So there are certain limits that can be culturally transmissible. But then if you're a 16-year-old having your first drink, which you shouldn't do because that's illegal, kids, don't do that, you're not going to know if you throw up after 2 or 20.
Due to a technical difficulty, I've had to get my laptop. So there is a bit of a continuity error here, but it's fine. It's not going to disrupt anything in any way. So moving on from what you said a little bit, I would say that vice has both an inward and outward component. It has an inward destructive component and an outward destructive component as well. And the inward one is obviously quite distinct to the outward one, in that it's sort of unavoidable for there to be inward destruction, because by definition, if it is a vice, it is having some sort of detrimental effect upon your personal life in some way. Mm. And so that's unavoidable. But the outward component, people can simply avoid you, which again has inward consequences. But I'm not necessarily saying that that's desirable. I'm just saying that, you know, it's not quite as unavoidable as it could be. But obviously, if you have a vice, it's going to be detrimental to the people around you.
Yes.
And if you care about the people around you, which you should, it is not only irresponsible, it is also going to be very destructive to them. You could harm them, which will obviously make you feel very bad about yourself.
Also, it's just, even if you don't have any direct consequences of harm, for example, if you get hooked on an addictive substance and you're not threatening to stab a family member for money to buy crack with, right? That's an extreme example. Even if it's not that, even if everyone has at least one family member who is not in a state of readiness when crisis strikes, you end up with the Fall of Rome meme with a smug soy jack superimposed in front of it saying, well, how does this affect you personally? Because it has a scaling issue, right? If you have the immediate consequences of detrimentally impacting your family because you're hooked on a vice, then one, it's hard to avoid a family member because of those inextricable sentimental bonds. You're born dependent. We're all in units. It's difficult to break.
Well, by definition, having a dependency makes you less adaptable because you are dependent on something. I mean, there are things that we are dependent on that we can't avoid. Like for the pedants in the comments, yes, I'm dependent on drinking water and eating food. You know, that is a dependency, but that is, you know, one of the feasible things of being a material being. Right?
Yeah, but I mean the non-material aspect of being. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that you are enmeshed in a family dynamic, even if that family dynamic is adverse, abusive, or that you want to cut someone out, it's still painful to do so. And just look at San Francisco, for example. The amount of people that you have to step over on the pavement that are dying of drug addiction over time does build up the alienation factor, does contribute to social decay. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there is an element of avoidability as long as it's confined to one tramp per town who's a bit of a drunk. But if the costs of vice are diminished culturally and materially, then it incentivizes people that aren't quite as cognizant of the moral dimensions of vice to just become addicted to it. And that does have a social contagion effect, which erodes the social fabric. Mm-hmm.
As someone who lives in Swindon, I'm well aware of the environmental effects of crackheads ruining everything.
Yeah, fair point.
In fact, just the mere mention of them makes me sneeze in an allergic response. I'm just that much of a snob. So the behaviour of, say, vice, if you will, can take three different forms, which vary in severity. And these are things that are reflected in the literature, but I've kind of put my own sort of spin on it, if you will, but that is not too out there necessarily. So there's excess, which are things like risk-taking, gambling, some substance abuse, sexual promiscuity, that I think is fair to label them as excessive because they're beyond the realm of normal behavioural function. It's mm-hmm. suggesting there's some sort of maladaptive reason to be going towards those things more so than might seem healthy, but it hasn't got to the point where there's necessarily explicit and obvious negative side effects yet. And we're going to be talking about excess a bit later, but first we're going to be tackling addiction, which is the supposedly the most severe. I would say that's pretty self-evident, really. And that's, of course, again, substance abuse, but in a more severe state. You can be addicted to video games, although I have covered that before and have said many positive things about it. Pornography and pretty much anything that acts on the neural reward system. So you can become sort of addicted to running, for example, because that has a neurochemical release. Although, obviously, being addicted to running and being addicted to heroin are not equal things.
Yeah.
I know, it's such a bombshell. And the final one, which I'm going to call the biblical vices, things like greed, lust, envy, lying, cheating, that sort of thing. That's more akin to moral vices, personal.
Character defects, yeah.
Yeah, and I've kind of tacked these on at the end because some people may label these vices, some people may not. They may see them as independent things. But I thought I'd include them just to be thorough, although they're not necessarily going to be the focus because I think these are virtues or lack thereof. And so I think looking at them with a slightly different lens might be warranted. But first, I suppose it's worthwhile pointing out the work that I've done so far. You feature in a couple of these, actually. So I've done a couple of contemplations tackling this sort of thing. Are we a civilization of drug addicts, where me and you looked at various common things like prescription opiates and the contraceptive pill and all the things that we've become dependent on as a civilization and how they're detrimentally affecting us. And I think the term drug addict is fair because, of course, you can't get addicted to, say, the contraceptive pill. But our society is dependent upon its use, at least in its current state. Not saying that it's good, but I'm saying that people rely on it, which shouldn't be a controversial statement. And then we also have, if I can use a mouse properly, this one here, which is, again, mine and yours, the psychology and morality of pornography, where we're talking about that sort of thing and explaining why it might be detrimental to both you and other people around you. And although we came down on different sides about whether it should be banned or not, we agreed on the detrimental effects.
Yes.
And then finally, this is one I did with Harry, are video games bad for you? And basically my premise was, if you're addicted to them, yes. And if not, they can actually be quite good for you, depending on what kind of game, because people like to lump games all in together. But you'll have to find out which distinctions I made in this contemplations. I mean, I'm plugging it, but of course, you're already watching this, so you may well have watched them already. But it's just worthwhile to remind you of the kind of things I've kind of built off of to talk about this. So I'm going to talk about addiction now. And again, as I said before, this is probably one of the most pervasive forms of vice. People often euphemistically refer to it as a habit. And I think that is kind of getting to the core of it, is that it's something that you do repeatedly. It's something that cannot be shaped. And so it has that sort of habitual character. And I know that Aristotle said that virtue is basically habit forming, which I agree with. He's right to say so. Then vice must be sort of the inverse of that, in a sense. You're habituating a bad pattern of behavior rather than a good one in virtue.
Yeah, so to link the biblical vices with vices that are reliance on certain substances or behaviors, I would say that the behaviors or substances are the enabling condition to put you in a moral deficit, like a inhibited state of readiness for that crisis which strikes. Because certain vices like gambling, drinking, pornography, hard drugs, they do have an addictive element, and so they can reformat your brain chemistry. Mm-hmm. And
I will be touching on that soon.
Yeah, and so weaken your defenses against succumbing to certain underlying character flaws which draw you to that substance in the first place. Mm-hmm. So the mouth pleasure of fast food, for example, makes greed a hell of a lot easier to do, but you have to have been greedy as a prerequisite motivation, otherwise you wouldn't be indulging in all that food. It does, just because there is that adverse psychological effect doesn't morally exculpate you from overindulging in that thing in the first place. Does that make sense?
Sure. I mean, to kind of steel man your example here, there's a guy who looks a bit like John Lennon, weirdly enough, who eats nothing but Big Macs for the past 20 years. And he's not fat. In fact, he's quite skinny, actually, because he only has two a day. And that's his food. And I mean, that's really weird. But, you know, it's a sign that you can go to McDonald's every day and not be a great big fat person. To accidentally quote Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs. So there is a sort of sweet spot, if you will. You can have fast food every now and then, and it's not going to kill you. It's not really going to do too much harm, but it's about being cognizant of the effect it's having upon yourself. I think that's the main thing I want to draw home, is that just be reflective on what's going on in your life. And with an addiction, sometimes it's very difficult to tell when it passes from sort of excess to an actual addiction. Like, I've been addicted to caffeine before, and I didn't really realize it. I would just have a habit of having a morning coffee, and sometimes I'd be irritable because I enjoyed my morning coffee when I didn't have it. And I've just presumed, well, this is the nice thing. This is my treat for going through the boring old morning routine. And then I realized, oh yes, this is, you know, all of the hallmarks of a sort of physical addiction.
I was actually, to come back on your Final Contemplations blog example, I was addicted to games as a teenager. I got really good at first person shooters. Like, I was
Call of Duty in particular.
I was unbelievably good at Call of Duty.
I was playing a lot of that when I was a teenager. I got in, like, I think at one point I was playing so much that I was in like the top 10,000 on Xbox Live in the world, which is very sad. That was for Team Deathmatch, which is really lame, and I'm ashamed to say it.
Yeah, I used to float in the semi-pro circles, made a little bit of money. I did Destiny raid runs. I did crap tons of Titanfall. I was near top 500 on the European servers for Overwatch for a bit. I was properly sweaty, and my social life deteriorated as a result. And so this is perhaps why I'm a bit more hardline on these things. It's that for certain people, there are certain things which are irresistible. It's like the monkeys that are genetically predisposed to alcoholism. Like, you don't know until you let the monkey drink. So sometimes, the occasional bag of McDonald's fries, I mean, seed oils, sure, but they aren't the worst thing in the world for you. But don't fill your life with things that degrade you and impede your progress as a person that other people can rely on. And also, there are certain things you don't need to try because it almost isn't worth the risk falling under their sway.
Yeah, heroin, meth, perhaps. I mean, I've done neither. Funny that. It's probably because they don't look too appealing even, you know, from the outside. You see the consequences of what it does to people. You're just like, you know what? Even if that's the best thing in the world, you know, it's like
I'd
an
rather
experience.
Keep my teeth, yeah.
Yeah, it's clear that they're not necessarily having a good time in other aspects of their life.
Yeah.
And so you don't need to do it to necessarily see it. But I think for most people we're talking to today, it's going to be a bit more pervasive. It's not going to be as obvious and common sense as that. And even so, I mean, sometimes people who are very, very depressed will turn to hard drugs, and it's like a palliative measure to keep them supposedly in the world, if you will. You know, it allows them, it gives them some sort of pleasure, and then eventually they can recover. So it's a very complicated thing in a way, in that sometimes drug addiction can save someone who's suicidal, which obviously I don't, definitely don't go out and do drugs if you're suicidal. That's not a good idea, but it does seem to be that there's some sort of weird function there that I suppose it's like a comfort blanket in a sense. I think that's probably it, that they have a bit of momentary closure on their problems, which allows them to then approach them with a bit of freshness, potentially. Hopefully so, anyway. But we're not going to focus on that necessarily. So one thing I wanted to focus on about addiction is that calling it a disease, I think, is a bit misleading, and it kind of winds me up a little bit, in that it implies a sort of pathogen, doesn't it? It implies that there's a foreign contaminant, which, I mean, if you're, you know, taking drugs or drinking alcohol, whatever, I mean, that is a drug. But if you're doing those things, that's still introducing something external, but it's kind of, it functions in a different way. And I don't think conflating the two is necessarily helpful. And also, addiction is bad enough in its own right. It doesn't need to piggyback on other concepts to be seen as bad. Like, it destroys people's lives, it destroys families. I don't think you need to say, oh, it's a disease, though, just like obesity. Yeah, obesity is bad enough. You don't need to call it a disease.
Yeah, you can't involuntarily contract being fat.
Yeah. Unless someone's force feeding you, I don't know. I mean, whatever you're into, I suppose. But don't do that, it's weird. So yes, I think there's also a very detrimental psychological aspect that people overlook, is that you're taking an active role in the maintenance of your own affliction. Like, addicts are well aware that they're addicted and they don't feel good about it, but they feel so bad physiologically and potentially psychologically as well, that they feel like their hand is forced to repeat this negative behavior. And that is akin to a form of torture in my mind. And of course, this is immensely destructive to one's own notion of self and one's own self-worth and their sort of self-esteem, that sort of thing. I suppose that's just another word for the same thing.
I don't know if you would know, but do you know if more addicts report their brain kind of going on autopilot when they indulge in a particular vice? Or is it that more addicts try and hyper-rationalize their urges to themselves to justify indulging?
It would be a combination of both, because of course habits are unconscious most of the time, right? You have to consciously cultivate a habit so then you don't have to consciously do it. That's why people, you know, go out of their way to say, okay, I'm going to the gym, and then eventually it's going to be a habit, you don't even question it. And so it seems like there is a sort of unconscious automatic aspect to it, but also you've got a sort of bipartite brain, don't you, in the unconscious and the conscious both have to be working in tandem for the continuity of a certain behavior. And if the conscious mind is making excuses for the unconscious desires, which we quite often do a lot of the time, like we post hoc rationalize why we did something, which isn't always helpful, but sometimes it's impossible to kind of introspect as to why we made a certain choice, because by definition, if the unconscious is involved, then it's not available to your conscious introspection. You can speculate with knowledge of your own behavior and kind of come to a best guess, but you can't really know for certain about that. And I think that that's one of the complicated aspects. And I think people who are most immune to the destructive things that we're going to talk about today are people who are very reflective and people who are aware of what they're doing and able to do that well. And I think that that inoculates you to the negative excesses, because you spot the mistakes in your own reasoning for your own behavior quicker than other people might. You won't necessarily have to fall afoul of something to see that it might lead you down a bad path. And that's really what I want to encourage people to do. There is a solution here to vices and detriments. And that is just sitting and thinking about it and trying to solve it. It's, of course, with drug addiction and things like that, there's a lot of physical stuff, you know, checking yourself into rehab, removing yourself from an environment that encourages it, making sure the incentives are in your favor to promote good behavior. Those are all things you need to do as well. But if it's sort of on the lower level, the sort of bad behavior that everyone has to a certain extent, then introspection is the main antidote. And I think that everyone could benefit from that. I don't think there's anyone that could not benefit from doing that. And it's something that I really, really try and do myself, and has done innumerable good for me. I don't think I'd be the person I am today. I don't think I'd be here in the seat today that made it sound like I'd be dead. I don't mean that. I mean, like, I'm not sure I would have succeeded enough to be here had I not been sufficiently introspective in mitigating my worst excesses. I think that it leads you down a not necessarily a dark road, but a self-destructive one in a sense. So, I mean, sometimes there are limitations to self-destruction, aren't there? In that you can't really go out binge drinking very easily on a hangover. That's a very physical limitation on what you can do. But just to kind of highlight the nature of addiction, people, this is based on the psychological literature, people can be addicted to getting tattoos and piercings, stealing, pet ownership, using hand sanitizer, cleaning, pulling hair, plastic surgery, tanning, eating ice, which took me by surprise. Apparently 2% of men over the age of 18 in the US compulsively chew ice. I've never heard of this, by the way. But 2% of the male population is a bit mental, actually.
I've met a few girls who compulsively pull hair out of stress, so it doesn't surprise me.
Well, it's an actual phrase, isn't it, to mean stressed. So yeah. Eating dirt, apparently that's more common in the third world.
Or in the home office, probably.
Yeah, that's public policy. Yeah. And also hylophagia, which is eating glass, which I imagine wouldn't be pleasant to go out of your system. Also, 10% of high-performance runners are addicted to exercise, and similarly, about 10% of bodybuilders are also addicted to going to the gym. Mm. So that 10% seems to be a recurring figure, although, of course, there are lots of different aspects of methodology and sampling that could vary that, and lots of factors that interplay it. And a simple statistic at face value isn't worth much.
There's also probably body dysmorphia, anorexia, and like comorbidities.
There are lots of complex factors that inform these things, because, of course, the human brain, as far as we know, is the most complex thing in the known universe. And so we like to think of ourselves as being very simple, but we're not. We're actually very complicated. And it's one of the sort of revelations in psychology is that, wow, the more you dig, the more complex things are. And there's really not much limit to the complexity of it, in a sense.
So this might be our sticking point mutually on the addiction is a disease point. No, addiction is often a maladaptive coping strategy for an underlying comorbidity like depression or anxiety.
Well, if you feel the need to do something that lifts your mood, there must be a dearth of mood in the first place. So it's kind of definitionally true.
Yeah.
So moving on to the sort of health professional definition of addiction. Here is the NHS website, of course, fountain of all knowledge, the NHS, not really. But they have some interesting things that they've highlighted as particularly significant. Some people are addicted to work. apparently, this is number one on the NHS website. I'm not making a personal attack at you, Connor, don't worry.
I think it's a little bit known that I'm a touch of a workaholic, so that doesn't...
I think... as far as addictions go, it's one of the most productive.
Yeah, true, but it does burn you out.
I think everyone gets burnt out eventually, don't they? It's particularly if they're in a high, if they push themselves to get into a high stress environment where there's lots of responsibility, where you've got lots of expectations on you, it takes an emotional toll over time. There's only so much you can bear of stress, because stress is a neurochemical thing that, of course, things like cortisol, that sort of thing. I'm not going to go into that because it'd be a massive tangent, but basically it erodes the functionality of your body over time, particularly your immune system makes you susceptible to illnesses. And so your overall sensation of being degrades over time with stress. So it's no small thing. It is very significant. Internet addiction. Get off the internet. Stop watching this. Go outside. No, don't do that.
Don't cancel your subscription though, please.
Yeah. Solvents, I don't really understand this one. Like sniffing glue, it's just like, come on, go professional with your drug use or go home.
It's the Charlie from It's Always Sunny addiction.
I know, yeah. It's a weird one. It's basically pointless. All of them are pointless, obviously. Yeah. And shopping as well.
The female addiction.
Yes, I despise shopping. I see it as a massive chore. Very male-brained in that respect. Yeah. I take no pleasure from it, other than mocking the ridiculous things that are in high street shops, like the clothes in particular. I enjoy berating them because I derive pleasure from misery, of course.
I feel like there needs to be more seats outside changing rooms so that we can have like a male bonding exercise of all mm-hmm. the put upon boyfriends and husbands that are forced to sit there while your girlfriend tries on 10 dresses and doesn't actually wear any of them.
Mm-hmm. The seating area, you know, where people normally go to try and choose, yep. becomes like a creche for
yep.
for men in relationships. There's always a kind of exchange of, oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah. They should have like magazines on sheds or something on the table in the middle.
I hope you enjoyed that segment from Contemplations, my series. And if you want to watch the full conversation, which that was taken from, all you need to do is sign up to our website for £5 a month and you can watch all of the content we have there. Thank you very much for watching and goodbye.